Love is the new Beatles album, or at least it's the new remix of the Beatles masterminded by George Martin, their original producer, and his son Giles. They've created new works using nothing but the sounds the Beatles put in tracks in the 60s. Here's an example of the Love album, this version of While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Gently weeps. I look at the floor and I see it needs sweeping. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told you how to unfold your love. I don't know how someone controlled you. They bought and sold you. I look at the world and I notice it's turning while my guitar gently weeps. With every mistake we must surely be learning. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know how you were diverted. Were perverted too. I don't know how you were inverted. No one alerted you. I look from the wings at the play you are staging. While my guitar gently weeps, as I'm sitting here doing nothing but aging, still my guitar gently weeps.
While My Guitar Gently Weeps from Love, the new Beatles production, commissioned by Cirque du Soleil and realized by our guest today, Sir George Martin, the Beatles' original producer, and his son, Giles. Martin signed the Fab Four to Parlophone in 1962 and produced them throughout their recordings. Sir George turns 81 this January. Believe me, he has some tales to tell. And I started out asking him how he got involved with the Love Project.
When I was approached, first of all, with this this show with Cirque du Soleil, I knew what had been going on, but I wasn't sure that it had actually reached maturity. And Neil Aspinall of Apple came to me and said, "Would you like to do the music for this show? Because what we would like you to do is to construct around about an hour and a half of continuous music from the Beatle recordings and not use any live sounds, not use any orchestra, but just create the soundtrack from the tapes that you've worked on for so many years with the Beatles, way back in the 60s. And he said, "We give you absolute license to do with those tapes whatever you fancy doing." And it was really an offer I couldn't refuse. I mean, it was such a a trip to go on, to be given that freedom to just do what you thought was right for an exciting new show. So that's what we did.
Did you immediately involve your son Giles?
Yeah. My first thought, in fact, was that I really can't do this by myself. I need somebody to help me on this. And my immediate thought was my son, Giles, who is excellent in so many ways. He's a very good producer, very good musician, and he has two things that I don't have. First of all, he's got a marvellous pair of ears, and secondly, he's got a very deep understanding of modern technology and what you can do with digital sound, which I've got a grasp of, but not as good as he has. And he actually can manipulate all the sounds. So he became my co-producer and engineer, really.
Did you end up working with at any time with the original Beatles tapes, or what were your original source material?
Yes, we did work with all the original Beatles tapes. They'd been stored for years and years here at Abbey Road, down in the cellars, in a special vault. And I must say that they've been well looked after. The tapes were in good condition. But the first thing we did was to transfer everything into a hard disk, digital. And surprisingly, this hadn't been done. I mean, all the Beatles recordings were still in the analog original state that they were, four tracks, two tracks, eight tracks, on tape, of course. So we were working from the original sounds, and I think what we did was to not change them, but we actually made them more presentable and more... I think the sound has been enhanced by modern technology.
Here comes the sun, do-do-do. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. Little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun.
People know a lot about the Beatles, but maybe not as much about you, Sir George. And where did your interest in music begin?
Well, I've always been interested in music from a child. We had a piano in our house, and I really cannot remember a time when I couldn't make a bit of music on that little piano. You know, from the age of five onwards, I just taught myself and found out about music myself. I've played around with different chords and got terribly excited when I found a new chord. By the time I was 15, I was running a band. But you didn't think about making that a career in those days. I never thought I'd be doing that when I was a grown man. It was just good fun to do, you know, and earned a little bit of money on the side when you're a teenager. I was flying with the Navy during the war, and when I came out, I hadn't really gotten anything to do. And there was a very well-known professor of music that I'd met in my travels, and he was enormously encouraging. And he said, "You really must take up music because you've got it." And I said, "Well, I'm too old now." By this time, I was 21. I said, "You know, I can't go back to school." He said, "Yes, you can." And he said, "You being an ex-serviceman, you can get a government grant to study for 3 years, and you can come work at our college," which was the Guildhall in London, which is what I did. And I was signed on as a student of composition, orchestration, conducting, and I took up the oboe as a second instrument, which I was able to earn a living at when I emerged. So that was basically how I all got started.
Now, how did you make the transition from there to working in the music business and the engineering end of it?
Well, the kind of fairy godfather who turned me into a musician at the Guildhall also led me into the direction of recording, because one of his mates was the senior producer at EMI for opera, and one of his mates was the guy who ran Parlophone Records, and he was looking for an assistant who could do some classical recording for him. And fortunately, it was the kind of music I liked, because it was music of the Baroque period of Beethoven, and before him, Bach and Buxtehude and all those kind of people. And had a great group called the London Baroque Ensemble, which I took charge of, and I enjoyed it. But in no time at all, I was asked to do lots of other things as well.
Now, what was the recording equipment like when you started out? Was it all one track or two track? Was it all about mic placement and things like that then?
Well, EMI Abbey Road in 1950, which is when I joined, was much the same as it looks today, but the equipment was completely different. For a start, we didn't even record on tape. I mean, far less digital. We recorded on direct disc of wax discs that were cut on a lathe in real time as the music was played, so that all the music was divided into little sections. If you had a 10-inch record, you would try not to make it last more than 2¾ to 3 minutes long, and if it was a 12-inch record, you had about 4¼ minutes to play with. But the trouble was that the longer you made your recording, the quieter it became, because you had to put the grooves closer together on the record. It was pretty primitive stuff. And I think that this can be driven home by the fact that the lathe that we worked on, the engineer worked on, wasn't driven by electricity, because electricity was so unstable that if you'd relied upon that, you would have ended up with a record with a lot of wow on it. So it was driven by the most constant source of power known to man, and that is gravity. And before each take, the engineer would wind a heavy weight to the ceiling, and then when he wanted the turntable to go around, he flicked the switch and the weight would start falling, and 78 RPM, dead steady as rock, came up. And that was how I first met the recording world. Now, there were tape machines in existence at that time, but their signal-to-noise ratio was so horrendous that we didn't use them to begin with. And gradually, as they got better, we did. But it was still mono, and stereo was still to turn up in our domain anyway. And in fact, stereo originally was used just for classical records, so that all pop records were mono.
Now, when you moved over to the pop end of things at Parlophone and originally began working with the Beatles, people may not know this, but they used session musicians during the recordings of records rather than using the actual bands. Why was that?
Well, we did use session musicians for singers, but we also used actual bands, as you put it, if they were an existing band. So that, I mean, in America, you had Glenn Miller and you had Woody Herman and those kind of people, and they obviously recorded, they didn't use session musicians. Similarly here, we would have, amongst the jazz bands, we would have Humphrey Littleton and Freddie Randall and Joe Daniels and so on. But for pop records, it was generally solo singers like Shirley Bassey, who's still with us, Matt Monro, all sorts of good singers like that. And they didn't have a band, so we had to provide the accompaniment for them, which is where the session singers came in, and which is where a good arranger came in to score for the session singers. And we still do that today with singers. We still provide them with session musicians.
But you didn't do that with the Beatles. Why did you figure that they were different?
Well, the Beatles were a good band, except that after the first time I heard them, I took Brian on one side and said, look, I like what I'm hearing and I like the boys, but I don't think they've got enough consistency in their drumming and their drive. I think it's a bit dull. I think we could do with a better drummer. So next time they come along, I shall provide you with a session drummer, a guy called Andy White I booked, and he'll be much better than this guy, who was Pete Best. And I said, you needn't tell the world, you know, everybody can think it's Pete Best, and that's fine. And he said, okay then. But when they did turn up, they turned up with a fellow with a long nose called Ringo Starr. And I didn't know him from Adam, but I learned later he was a pretty hot drummer with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. But I'd already booked Andy White. And they said, but we've got our drummer. I said, well, I don't know what he's like. I mean, your last one wasn't very good. Why should this one be any better? So I wouldn't let him play. And he didn't like that at all, and he's never let me forget it either. Obviously, when I found out how good he was, he became a regular part of the recording band. But on that first session, it was Andy White playing drums for most of it. I think Ringo played tambourine in a bit.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please, love me do.
Now, as you got to know them, did you work with them differently than you would with other musicians?
The first thing I had to do with the Beatles was to find out what to do with their sound, you know, because they were something I hadn't heard before. I mean, mostly the groups that you get in the studio, like Cliff Richard, was a solo singer with a backing band, like Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas and Jerry and the Pacemakers. They had a band of which the singer was probably a part, but he was the leader. But here you had a group of characters where three of them were singing, sometimes simultaneously, and there was no clear leader. I mean, it was a toss-up, really, between John and Paul, and I was still trying to work it out. And I was, on that initial meeting, I was saying to myself, well, who am I going to make the star here? Who is going to be the one who steps up in the limelight? And it wasn't until I got home, the light suddenly hit between my eyes, and said to myself, what are you on about? Why don't you take them as they are? Just record them as a whole group.
Now, there are a number of times when you stepped in to arrange something or have something played for a Beatles composition, and there are a number of those, and I was wondering what your favorite musical contribution to their work was.
Yeah, well, obviously the most famous one is the quasi-harpsichord solo in In My Life, but there are lots of others buried in the music of the Beatles that people don't know about. I mean, for example, the middle part of Michelle. Dum da da dum da da dum bum. That's mine.
I love you.
In My Life, the boys had gone out to dinner and left this. We always left gaps for the solos, and I wasn't quite sure. Nobody knew what they were going to put into In My Life. So I thought I'd try something. And while they were away, I got onto the keyboard and I wrote this little two-part invention, Bach kind of thing. I wasn't good enough to play it up to speed with both hands together. So to get it right, I lowered the pitch of the original recording by half, but it enabled me to play the complete thing, both left and right hands, at that speed. And it had a further advantage that when it was played back and sounded quite brilliant, the way the playing was, I thought I was really clever. But the sound also changed because each piano note became half the length it would have been otherwise. So it sounded quite brittle, and everyone thought it was a harpsichord. It's a nice piece of music, and everybody liked it. The Beatles loved it, which is great.
Now, you were the fly on the wall. You were the one that was there, and all the creativity that went into the Beatles recordings. Could you describe the atmosphere in the studio during these making of Sgt. Pepper's?
Well, of course, Sgt. Pepper lasted quite a few months, and I mean, we started out in November 1966, right through to April 67. We weren't working all the time, but we were concentrating on what the whole thing was going to be. And to begin with, to describe the atmosphere, it was a sense of freedom to begin with, because for years the Beatles have been on their golden treadmill. For 4 years they've been touring the world, locked in hotel rooms, eating hotel food, not seeing much of their families. And it was a boring existence. I mean, they were enormously popular, enormously successful, earning many, many dollars. But at the same time, they weren't getting any happier, and they were having really unhappy experiences in Germany. They were threatened with death. They had all sorts of weirdos coming out of the woodwork. When they went to the Philippines, due to a misunderstanding, there was a huge row, and they were chucked out of the country. And of course, there was all that business with John shooting his mouth off about them being more popular than Jesus, which I knew what his intention was, because he was speaking the truth, but it didn't go down too well in the Bible Belt, and all their records started being burnt and all that kind of stuff. And they turned to Brian and they said, "We've had enough of this. We don't want to do this anymore. We're not going to perform again." And this shook Brian, because it was his main source of income. And they said, "Well, no, we're going to work in the studio with George, and without any time restrictions," which was for me great, because up to then I'd been allocated a little day here and another evening or afternoon there. And it was hard getting really great stuff out of them in such a short time. Now, suddenly, in November 66, we were able to go into the studio and work until we decided not to. And the first thing we started out on was Strawberry Fields Forever, which is, of course, one of the great icons of all time, as far as I'm concerned. A wonderful song. And that was the beginning of Sgt. Pepper. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields.
Now, Rolling Stone magazine has touted that as the best album of all time. Do you remember the reception when it first came out?
Yeah, well, the reception in England was pretty good. I mean, most young people thought it was a fantastic record. Some old folk thought it was outrageous. Some people thought it was inspiring young people to go the wrong way and start taking drugs. I mean, the BBC, for example, banned the playing of A Day in the Life. They said it was anarchic and shouldn't be played, so it never was aired on the British Broadcasting Corporation, which I thought was a bit stupid. They've played it since, of course. I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, to begin with, I was a little bit scared that we were pushing our frontiers too rapidly and maybe people wouldn't catch up with us. But I was wrong, because when the record came out, everyone was with us. And it was great. And all we had to do then was worry about what we're going to do next.
All You Need Is Love kind of became the hippie anthem of the summer of love here in the States. What did you first think when you heard that song?
All You Need Is Love is still a damn good song. And when you think about the way it started, Brian came to me and said, "You know, we've been selected as being the band that should represent Great Britain in a worldwide hookup between all the countries in the world on television, and they'd be live. You up for it?" I said, "We're fine, absolutely. But what are we going to do?" "Well, either John or Paul or both of them will write a special song." Well, John came up with All You Need Is Love. And it was a great anthem. I mean, it was a great message anyway, because it's still... it's my motto, my family motto now, when I had my my crest done after I got knighted. And I think it's such an apt one. And it's become everybody's thought, anybody who thinks a lot about humanity, that it is true that all you need is love. And if you spread love around a bit, love is all you need. And that was the... It was a simple song. And when we did it live here in the number one studio where I'm sitting now, with an invited audience, but an audience worldwide of 200 million going out live, it was a wonderful occasion. I'd booked a band and I'd done the arrangement for the backing. I'd taken a bit of precaution by pre-recording the rhythm just to be sure that we didn't break down in the middle of it. But most of it was live. And I thought the song was great and the broadcast was good. And I still think of it's great. And it ends up our love record, which is just come out.
Working on the love record, working in the studio as you've gotten older, a lot of engineers, producers, and particularly musicians who play live a lot suffer hearing loss. Has that been a problem for you, and is it work-related?
Yeah, well, working in the studio hasn't been more difficult for me as I've gotten older because, you know, you get experience and things come more easily, and if you're a good musician, you can put that to good use. And I've been so lucky to work with so many good people in my life, not the least of which are the rank and file musicians over here in England. They're really great people, but of course I do suffer from hearing loss, and a lot of musicians do. A lot of famous people have hearing problems, but you see, in the 60s, nobody warned us about this. It's like in the 30s, nobody told you shouldn't smoke because you'll get cancer. And in the 60s, nobody said, if you listen to loud sounds for too long, you're going to get deaf. And they didn't tell you either that there was a delayed effect. And so I preach the gospel wherever I go. All my recording engineers are under pain of death not to use excessive sounds. And I always tell young people, if they go to a disco or somewhere like that, or a rock concert, if the noise is really obscenely high, then they should limit themselves, ration themselves. And if for 1 hour of subjected heavy music, they should get out and listen to silence for 10 minutes. And that will help. That will stop them getting deaf. Because it's not just the loud sounds that deafen you. It's the duration of the loud sound that does it. And I was listening. I was in the control room listening to loud sounds for 18 hours a day. And I'm afraid that's why I now have got bad hearing. And I don't like it. And nothing I can do about it. I do wear hearing aids, but it's not the same. I've just come to the conclusion in my advanced state of life that God has a sense of humor, and he decided to take away the one thing that's made me so good at, music.
Sir George Martin, our guest today on the World Cafe, and you've accomplished so much in your life. This is really a difficult question, but from your life so far, what would you want to be remembered for?
Oh, gosh, I don't really want to be remembered at all except by my family, and I hope I'm remembered by them with love. I guess I'm, you know, I've had more than my share of fame and adulation, and I do appreciate it. I think the people, my fans, have been absolutely wonderful. But after I'm gone, I don't want them to think any more about it. That's it. There's somebody else they'll latch onto, which would be great. And I won't care about it anyway because I won't be around. So I don't mind.
Sir George Martin, our guest today, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been nice talking to you.
Again, thanks to Sir George Martin for spending time with us. That new production of the Beatles music, Love, is available now. And if you're looking for it, you'll find it at our World Cafe CD store at our website, which is worldcafe.npr.org.